welcome to another episode of Ibiza Unlocked podcast. In today's episode, we're going to be talking to none other than Fatboy Slim. Norman Cook, a gentleman, been in the music industry since the tender age of 15. In the episode, he discusses his career. We go back in time to the House Martins and even prior to that. Norman has been a good friend of mine for many, many years. We met in the old days in Ibiza in the late 90s at Manumission, and we've always stayed friends ever since. And 3 years ago, he gave me a call and invited me to be involved with a fantastic film, Ibiza, the silent movie, of which he was the chosen musical director. Ladies and gentlemen, I introduce you to Fatboy Slim.
Hi Norman, it's Howard. You okay, mate?
How are you?
There's only one. There can be only one.
There's only one. Don't hear somebody described you the other day, Dirty Elvis.
Why on earth would they call me that?
I don't ever remember. I mean, I knew exactly who they meant. There was somebody who said, "Oh yeah, I met your mate Dirty Elvis." Oh, I think we got a friend in common in the beat of Dirty Elvis, and I was like, "Yeah, that sounds like someone I know."
Well, you know, it makes me laugh. We were talking about it the other week, weren't we? When we first met, and you said I look more like David Essex than I did Elvis.
Yeah, yeah. You'll never forgive me. Just that one throwaway comment. You never forgive me for it. No, it was just somebody who said they were going to go and stay with their friend who lives in Ibiza, and they said, "I think, do you know it's a friend of yours?" We'll work out who it is. Anyway,
it's a small world. My friends, it's a small world.
It's a small island. Yeah.
Before we touch on Ibiza the silent movie, I just wanted to talk about your background, how you started out in the music industry. Obviously, starting off with the House Martins as the bass player. How did all that come about?
Well, the House Martins was my first professional job in the music industry. But before that, I'd always been a DJ since I was 15. But in those days, DJing wasn't really a career. It was just a hobby you did because you like playing other people's records. I've always been in fact, when I say I gave up my day job to be a professional musician with the House Martins, my day job was working in a record shop. So everything in my life has always been kind of leading up to some kind of career in the music business.
Right, and are we missing something? There was a band before pre-House Martins, something about the Spongy Pond Pants.
The Stomping Pond Frogs. That's a good name, but no, we were called the Stomping Pond Frogs. Was a band I was in when I was at sixth form college, where with Paul Heaton, which is kind of a prototype to the House Martins. That's how I knew Paul. So that's how I ended up in Hull in the House Martins when I came from down south. It's just because I knew Paul from where we grew up. We were all in various college bands with stupid names, and that was the Stomping Pond Frogs was one of them.
I do love that band name. I'd love them to have a reunion. I can see them doing the headline slot at Glastonbury for the 50th anniversary next year.
Yeah, well, careful what you wish for. We're all still alive.
Well,
unlike the Beatles, we are all still alive.
Yeah. So, look, obviously, we know all about your history with the House Martins. We're leading all the way through from Beats International to Pizza Man to, obviously, your current stage name, Fatboy Slim, and all of the other work you've done along the way. And then one day, 2-3 years ago, the phone rang, and you got the gig for Ibiza the silent movie to become the musical director.
Yeah.
How did that come about? How was you the chosen one?
It just things falling into place. One piece was Malcolm Gerry, who I first met when I did The Tube, which is my first ever TV appearance.
Oh, you was on The Tube? You did that, yeah?
I did it a few times, but the first time I did it, yeah, Malcolm is he's a TV producer. And I've just kept in touch with him just over the years. I mean, 30 years in the biz, you make a lot of friends. And it's quite nice if you sort of keep them a bit, you know, like a bit like me and you. It's like there's a friend who's in place, and then sometimes your paths cross again. or you or something like that, and thinking, oh, man, I'll give them a ring. So I think Malcolm had always had me in mind to do something. And when he was doing the Ibiza project with Julian Temple, I think he probably remembered that I was a punk rocker at the time, and you know, that a very influential time in my life. And Julian was one of the kind of spokesmen for that generation. He recorded the archive of this story. So it was my relationship with Julian and like being a fan of his. So he just rang me up and said, might you be interested? And I was like, hell yeah, because I've always wanted to get involved in a film. I've always had a desire to get into that world of telling stories, using music to help tell stories. And I've always loved the way that music works in a good film. And so, yeah, it was coming together of something that I always wanted to do, somebody I always wanted to work with. But luckily enough, a subject matter which I was quite an authority on. So I could actually say to Julian, you know what, I'm the man for the job because I like you and how you work, and I know everything there is to know about this history of music. Yes, I got the gig. I said, don't talk to anyone, I'm the man. don't bother interviewing anyone else, I'm the man for the job.
It sounds like it didn't have to be a hard sell. Julian Temple making a film with Ibiza, it was a match made in heaven. And so it could only have been you.
I didn't realise they were actually interviewing me. I thought it was the other way around, you know.
But, you know, it turned out to be a beautiful film. And obviously, I'd like to say thank you for you getting me involved at that time to become the fixture of the film. So, again, thank you very much for that opportunity. I mean, deep love for the island, as you know, and you, as you have as well, a deep love for this island. I think that sort of shown with the music track selection that you curated for this film. So tell us a little bit about the tracks of choice. How did you do that? That must have been a bit of a mission.
I want to get more about your involvement more, because obviously I told Julian I knew everything that was to know about the island. I was bluffing you. You say those things in interviews to get the job. I realised I didn't know half as much of other people, so that's why I had to get Josh Ewing to fill in the blanks of. There's obviously a lot of my history with Ibiza. There's a lot of water passed under the bridge, but there's also an awful lot of blanks, things that I either don't remember or I never bothered to find out. So and it became quite an adventure, as you know. No one had ever quite made a film like that before, it went on a little bit longer than we thought. It was a little bit more complicated, but it got there in the end. But the music, again, I mean, it was normally the you have in a film, you have like 10 or 12 tracks which punctuate key scenes or themes for certain people. You know, every time that person emerges, there's a variation on that theme, and there's sort of ways that soundtrack music work. But of course this one, with in the absence of any dialogue or plot, the music had to really tell the whole story. And so it was a lot more important how it worked, and it was a lot more important. And just the sheer volume of it, like I said, normally there was, you know, 12 or 14 tunes in the soundtrack of the film. And when we first started to go into clearance, we had 94 tunes in it, 94 things, each fulfilling a different role. Which obviously we couldn't afford, and a lot of tunes we weren't allowed to use, and it was very complicated. The process of started with me and Julian swapping mixtapes with each other and going, oh, I like that one, and I would send him tons of stuff that was related to Ibiza, and he would send me tons of stuff that summoned the mood, and then somewhere in the middle we'd meet with music that meant something to the island but also meant something to the story he was telling. And it was a long and very, very complicated process. And in the end, we came down to, you know, me trying to get hold of, you know, an artist from the 70s and saying, please, please, can you waive your royalty? Or at least, you know, like, let your publishers do some kind of deal with us. So there was a lot of, you know, business involved, but it was all fun.
Well, I mean, look, you know, obviously you get a challenge there of some obscure tracks that, you know, the record labels haven't heard anything about for many years. All of a sudden, they get a call from Norman Cook saying, look, we want to use it for the film. And then no doubt, obviously, they wanted extortion fees. I think there, for one example, it was Pink Floyd, wasn't it? Dark Side of the Moon, was it? Or Shine On You Crazy Diamond in the end. We wasn't able to...
I don't want to name names, but there was a lot of people that we managed to circumvent the publishers and the record companies. And I was either Julian or I, between us, we've got, you know, extensive phone books where you can phone people up and say, you know, can we just talk to them? You know, we really like to use that thing. So yeah, people like Robert Fripp and there's various people that we kind of went through the back door and got them to allow us to do it.
Fantastic.
But again, that was half the fun of it. My bigger involvement in the film was introducing Julian to people like you and Mike and Claire and, you know, some of the sort of the characters who obviously he wouldn't know having not hung around.
Well, that's very kind of you to say, Norman. As I say, thank you very much for getting me involved with the film. And, you know, your input as the end result, I think I said this to you on the way back from the screening in Twickenham Studios, is I feel that the audio cuddles the visual in such a beautiful way and just guides it through. So, again, well done.
Fabulous. I'm not sure if that's a technical cinema, you know, cuddles it, but I love that imagery. I'll definitely take that. Well, no, I mean, that was lovely because that screening we went to together was, you know, all those sort of the time and anxiety and whatever we put was all sort of came down to that moment. Does it work? And you're saying, yeah, the music cuddles it. It's like, oh, my job here is done. Stop fretting about the fact we couldn't get Pink Floyd in the soundtrack. My job is done. Can I tell you a little interesting foot, though?
Go on.
Actually, which you know, but for the sake of whoever listening to this, was one of the first reactions where, which is the benchmark of, is this film any good, was doing a Q&A at the BAFTA, at the headquarters of BAFTA, doing a screening and a Q&A with Mark Kermode, who is in England, is like the number one film reviewer, does the film show on the BBC. And he, during that conversation, said, we started his review and his conversation with us. It's like, before seeing this film, I'd never been to Ibiza and I'd never been to a nightclub. So you are talking to, a complete idiot who knows nothing about it. And in his review, he said, and at the end of it, I thoroughly enjoyed it. He said, and that's the sign of a good documentary, is that, you know, for you to be interested, you know, find yourself interested in something that you hadn't previously been interested in. And that we've learned this week, he's gone one stage further, that Mark and his family are actually now on the island and ringing me and you up to find out which clubs to go to. So for me, that's like the ultimate accolade, that somebody who never bothered, even though he loves music, he's always loved kind of more 50s music, but the fact that after watching the film, he'd never had any interest in going to a beach, and he never had interest in going to a nightclub, and after watching the film he wants to do that. So we must have done something right. We must have turned people on.
Well, this is the biggest,
because we invited him to the cuddle.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm sure I'm going to be meeting him in the next couple of days. As you just said, he's a Julian passing my number, so I'm looking forward to meeting him. And I'm going to go easy.
He's coming to my party at Pies, I know that much.
Oh, right. I was about to say I'm going to go easy on him, but there's no chance of that if he's coming to your birthday party at Pikes.
Well, he's got three 18-year-old sons with him, so maybe he'll have to go easy on you.
I'm getting old.
Strange things happen at Pikes, who knows?
Anything can happen. So, look, Norm, I don't want to hold you up too much longer. I want to say two last things. For the world premiere at Glastonbury Cinema Armageddon, I mean, we couldn't have asked for a better result there. It was amazing, wasn't it? What a day.
Yeah. It's really surreal. After having made a film, you kind of think always about cinemas, people watching it in a cinema, and that's, you know, we were kind of mixing it in a room that was like a fake cinema and mixing it in cinema surround sound. And then what do? We play it to a load of drunken people in a field in the middle of Somerset wearing headphones.
Sitting in old burnt-out Cadillacs.
Yeah, sitting in burnt-out American cars. So, like, what a very, very strange way to launch it. But I think that's only fitting. But it was me and Julian's other common ground and love, which is Glastonbury, because we both have got a big interest in that.
So, and what was iconic about that is, I'm nearly finished now anyway, what was iconic about that was when you, Julian, and Michael Eavis, obviously Michael Eavis being the owner and founder of Glastonbury Festival, come driving through the Cadillac, which was a bit of a spectacle.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that you couldn't tell the teenage me. You know, one day you'll be driving in a Cadillac around the Glastonbury Festival with Michael Eavis and Julian Temple. Said, I know.
Crossed off the list of things to do that was never there.
Yeah, right. That never-ending list of things to do that you didn't know existed.
Brilliant. So lastly, what's for the future of the film? Are you going to be going on tour, doing some sets like you did after Cinema Armageddon, as soon as it finished, you played, which was great, by the way. So what's the plans next?
I don't know. The future is unknown, as Joe Strummer would say. I don't know exactly. It's such an unorthodox film. It's been promoted in a really unorthodox way. They've been doing screenings at like art house cinemas and putting it in into film festivals. So there's a couple of film festivals that I might go and do parties at in the same way that we did Glastonbury. And we're doing a screening on the pier in Brighton in August, which I'm going to do a little quick hello before. Nice to do one in your hometown. But beyond that, I think in this day and age, beyond that, I think if you're looking at Netflix and streaming rather than, because obviously it's not a commercial cinema, you know, release film. So once we've gone around the interesting places and the art house cinemas, you know, and this, you know, the serious things, I think the next thing probably would either be BBC4 or Netflix.
Yeah,
I mean, I'd love that. I think it would work in the way that thing about Fyre Festival.
Yes, for sure.
Fyre Festival. That just everybody watched it, but they all watched it, you know, at different times on Netflix rather than trying to persuade people. I know Julian had a dream of everyone dancing in the aisles in cinemas to it. But it's not that kind of film that you want to dance to it. There's lots of bad shit happens in it. There's lots of stuff that happens in it that you can't dance to. So, I think in a perfect world, probably sometime in the autumn, it'll go on Netflix. And that's probably when it'll have its biggest impact.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, at the moment, we're working in the background to do the On Ireland premiere before the end of the summer. But time is running out, but it's got to happen. It would be tragic if we don't show it on the islands this year.
Yeah.
So we're in the background.
That's the problem with it when you've got a film that A was never billed for, you know, worked out for a theatrical release, and then add the fact that you gave up working on any release deadlines about a year ago.
Yeah.
You know, I had no idea when it was going to be ready. You know, because we were going to show it at IMS last year, you know, 14 months ago. That was its original premiere. So we gave up on the idea of any kind of concerted, campaign of how it would be seen.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, it's been billed as the greatest, the loudest silent movie that was ever made. I think it's the loudest silent movie that no one's actually got to see yet. Everyone's talking about it, but no one's actually got to see it yet. But I think that'd be the way until it gets on the TV.
For sure. I think everyone should see it, especially on the island, across all generations, because it's a celebration of the island. It touches on the sustainability of the island, and it's an historical timeline of events. And I think it's a beautiful, beautiful film. And
because it's a celebration of the island. It's also a light-hearted history lesson, but it's also a voices some concerns about where the island's going. So yeah, I mean, it's a must for people to watch, whether or not, you know, whether they've been to the island or not, as Mark Domo. Just, you know, so you don't have to be interested in the island, but I assume people on the island would want to see it.
Yeah, no, you've hit that on the head, my friend. So that's us done. Thank you very much.
I'll tell you what, I'm over next week. what I'm going to do is me and my kids, we're going to go sell around hooky DVDs at all the hippie markets. That's our guerrilla distribution tactic. I'm going to run up a load of hooky DVDs. I'm feeling like San Carlos on the first day at the flea market.
We can dress Woody up as a looky man.
Yeah, right.
Well, I'm really looking forward to seeing you on Tuesday. It's going to cut around quick enough, so I'm going to get some rest in between now and then. But I will be seeing you there at Pike's.
Get some sleep in, because we're coming on Saturday.
You're coming on mass. The full crew.
Coming on mass. I'm bringing my whole family.
Fantastic. Well, I can't wait to see you. And thanks for your time today, mate.
All right, darling. No problem. Nice
lots of love as always.
I'll see you at the weekend.
Cheers, mate. Bye bye.
Please send your feedback to Howard at Ibiza Unlocked, and you can also check out www.ibizaunlocked.com for all things Ibiza, from film production services to villa rentals and sales to boat charters and yacht services. All things Ibiza for a full turnkey solution. Let us unlock Ibiza for you.